Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What awaits in the woods? Perhaps it is the forest poltergeist. We'll talk all about it with W.T. Watson on this edition of the Paranormal Podcast.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harrell, and so glad to be with you once again. And you know, we have our favorite guests around here at the Spooky Studio, and over the last few years, one of our favorites has become W.T. Watson. And we're going to talk with him today because he has a new book out. It's called The Forest Poltergeist, Class B Encounters and the Paranormal. And W.T. has such an interesting background. He's a best-selling author, a coffee addict, and a writer of both fiction and nonfiction. He infuses his work with his expertise in cryptozoology, monster lore, magic, Fortiana, and the paranormal. He brings a unique shamanic and magical perspective to all of his work after over 30 years of exploration in these topics. When he's not writing or reading about monsters, he can be found outdoors, allowing his dogs to take him for a walk around his neighborhood in Ontario. And we're so glad to have him with us. W.T., welcome to the Paranormal Podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me back, Jim. I'm really excited to be here.
So this book, The Forest Poltergeist. Now, on one hand, you think about Sasquatch, you think about cryptids and those kind of things. It's like, okay, that's one thing. And then you have poltergeist, and it doesn't seem like they go together, but you're saying they really do go together. Talk to us about the premise of the book and how you came up with it.
They really do go together. So let's start off with the idea. You know, in the title, there's this thing, Class B Encounters. You know, if you are involved in Sasquatch research at all, you quickly come across this idea of a Class A encounter being a visual sighting of Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And then you have these Class B encounters where people are encountering something in the woods, something in the wilderness that is creating disturbances out there, but and is attributed to Sasquatch, but is there's never actually a Sasquatch or Bigfoot seen. Examples of this are things like tree knocking, stone throwing, or you know that kind of thing, rock clacking, structures, these tree structures and nests that are seen out in the forest, tracks, vocalizations, and all those sorts of things. So those all count as Class B encounters because there is some kind of evidence, there's a disturbance. These disturbances are attributed to Sasquatch, but nobody actually sees the Sasquatch. The idea for this book came from my discussions with other podcasters, people in the paranormal, and so forth. One of these folks actually commented to me a lot of other people that if you took all of these Class B encounters, it's all of these things that are attributed to Sasquatch, and you place them inside a house, you'd have a poltergeist case. Now, I had been doing research and, I've had, sections on Sasquatch in Mysteries in the Mist, and I did a whole book on Class A visual encounters in Canada, Sasquatch Canada. So, I was fairly familiar with the Sasquatch lore, and it's always been an interest of mine. But this idea stuck in my head, and I decided that, once I'd finished work with Sasquatch Canada, that I'd go on and take a look at at this idea of poltergeists, you know, and what does this have to do with the Class B encounters? Do they really kind of mesh together? And as I did the research on poltergeists and some of the more famous poltergeist cases, and you know, delve more deeply into that world, I realized that anything that is attributed to Sasquatch in the wilderness, you can also find in a poltergeist case. Yeah. And so that's kind of where this idea of the forest poltergeist, other people have called it the wilderness poltergeist, comes together. And so the book explores that, you know, kind of cross-reference between these things that are attributed to Sasquatch on the one hand and the poltergeist phenomena on the other hand, and then proposes to some ideas about what might be going on out there besides, you know, large bipedal primates stomping around in the woods.
Well, that was going to be my question, because I think that most people probably think of Bigfoot as just another animal, if it exists. And I go back and forth on it. Even someone who does these programs, you know, sometimes I'm like, yes, it definitely exists. And sometimes I'm like, eh, I don't think so. So I'm ambivalent, interested. I'm open to it. I'm Bigfoot curious. But I guess what I would say is most of us think about it as an animal. It sounds like you think that it may be that and much more.
Well, you know, I have said throughout the course of my writing in Fortiana that, you know, I'm a both and thinker. I am perfectly all right with the idea that there might be a large undiscovered bipedal primate living in the wilderness areas of North America. I've said, and across the world, because obviously there's reports from other areas of the world as well. I have said, you know, on a number of occasions that, you know, Canada, for instance, is the second largest country in the world. It has hundreds of thousands of square miles of wilderness area that's barely ever touched by human beings. The vast majority of people in Canada live within about 150 miles of the U.S. border. So you've got all of that space otherwise that some large creature could exist in. We lost a whole species of bison here for several decades until it was rediscovered in the 1950s. So, yeah, bison's the largest land animal in North America by weight that we know of. So, you know, if those guys can disappear for a while in the Canadian wilderness, then just about anything can. So I'm not, you know, discounting the idea that there may be a physical creature. However, when you go and look at the different databases for Bigfoot sightings, Sasquatch sightings, you very quickly see that these creatures have supposedly been sighted in all of the contiguous 48 states of the United States, as well as all the provinces in Canada, except for Nunavut. Nunavut was the only place I couldn't find a Sasquatch sighting, and that may just be because of the population is not very big there. If we're talking about a rare, undiscovered primate, there's just no way that that critter can be in all the different places that it's credited with being. So there is something more going on there. And, you know, this is something that I explore a little bit in the latter portion of the book. Yeah. So again, I'm not opposed to the idea that there is a physical phenomena here, a physical animal. But I think that there is something more going on as well. And that's the premise of this book, particularly when it comes to these disturbances in the woods with the rock throwing and the wood knocking and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't necessarily mean there's a Sasquatch banging on trees. There could be something more going on.
Well, even taking it a step further, I know that Stan Gordon in Pennsylvania has done a lot of work on the coincidence of Bigfoot sightings and UFO sightings. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Stan's line of work in that regard?
Well, yeah, and anybody who, you know, explores the Sasquatch topic, who doesn't read the work of people like Stan Gordon or Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchin with their Where the Footprints End series, they're ignoring part of the evidence out there. There is significant anecdotes about Bigfoot being associated with UFO sightings. There's lots of stuff about Sasquatch and anomalous lights. Stan Gordon has a wonderful story in one of his books. I forget exactly which one it is, where a woman is sitting in her living room in Pennsylvania. She's watching television, minding her own business. Here's a disturbance out on her front porch. Thinks, hey, she's had some feral dogs in the neighborhood, so she's going to go take care of business. She gets her shotgun. She walks out onto the front porch of her house, and she's confronted by a 7-foot-tall Sasquatch. And the Sasquatch seems to be as surprised to see her as she is to see it. It throws its hands up in the air. She thinks she's being attacked, and she blasts this thing with a shotgun, and it disappears in a flash of light.
Wow. Now,
that's not something that physical creatures do. In Sasquatch, Canada, I have a whole chapter called Strange Things, which there's sections on, Sasquatch actually speaking to people mind to mind. But one of the interesting things that happens in that book as well is that there's a story of a native fellow who's driving down the road, Yellowknife, and sees a Sasquatch along the side of the road. It's walking down one of those power cuts where, they've opened the woods out so they can run power lines and stuff. It's walking down one of these power cuts, and he sees this Sasquatch. And, the indigenous people up here are very accepting of the idea that that these creatures exist. In fact, the Ojibwe count the Sabe, which is their word for what we call a Sasquatch, as one of the animals that's associated with one of their 7 primary virtues. But anyway, I'm digressing. So this fellow's watching this Sasquatch, and as he watches this creature walking down the road, it starts to become translucent. He can see through it. And as he's watching this creature, it walks off and it disappears completely. And that's not the only disappearing Sasquatch story I have in the book. But so in my mind, yes, there may be a physical creature, but there is also something more going on. And authors like Stan Gordon and the other people that I mentioned, do a good job of providing us with, anecdotes and evidence and so forth, telling us that there's something a little weirder going on than maybe some people want to admit.
Now, you did a chapter on the Black Monk of Pontefract. Can you tell us about that case? I know I've done a show on it at one point or another, but it's been a few years. Tell us about this, because that's a fascinating story.
Sure. I really, when I went, because of course there are, famous poltergeist cases, just like there are famous Bigfoot cases, right? Everybody, when you think of the Sasquatch phenomena, you think of the Patterson-Gimlin film and some of these other, really famous things that have happened, right? So I wanted to try and find a poltergeist case that maybe wasn't quite as well known. And the Black Monk is a case that was covered in depth by Colin Wilson in his book, which is just called Poltergeist. And it is the classic text on that particular phenomena. The Black Monk case is one of those cases where you just there's just a little bit of everything happening there. The family, it starts off with most of the family being on holiday, and the teenage son staying home with his grandmother, and they are hanging out in their sunroom, and suddenly there is this phenomena where there is white dust falling down from the ceiling, except it's not coming from the ceiling. It's coming from, it's basically apporting in from about a foot above, a foot below the ceiling, and it's drifting down and covering all the stuff in the room. Well, they're puzzled, of course. They have no idea what's going on. Grandmother's working on cleaning this up. They had, during that day, an outbreak of puddles of water that were forming in the house with no explanation. They actually called the local town council, and they sent out people to look at the pipes in the house. And there was nothing wrong with the plumbing in the house, but there were these puddles of water that were manifesting, throughout the home. You know, later in the day, grandmother and grandson are sitting in the kitchen, and there's a, a device for dispensing, sugar and so forth for tea that keeps rattling and dispensing more sugar onto the counter. So they're pretty well freaked out by this point, right? But they decide, things start to settle down a bit, and they decide they're going to go up and go to bed. Grandmother comes in to wish the grandson good night, and while he's watching over her shoulder, his chest of drawers basically begins to dance around behind her. I mean, it's bobbing all around the room. And that was it. They'd had enough. They had relatives in the area, and they decided they were going to go spend the night there. So that was the beginning of the case. As time went on, there was a break from there, and then later on, it picks up again. So there's so much stuff happening in this case, you really almost have to read Wilson's book to get the full flavor for it. But, you had things going on, like the mother waking up in the night. They'd been doing renovations on one of the bedrooms, waking up in the night and going in to check on the bedroom and finding the wallpaper peeling itself off the walls. And then, she commented on it. I don't remember exactly what it is. Something gets thrown at her, and she slams the door to the bedroom and goes back to bed. There's situations where the teenage girl in the house is actually ends up pinned underneath a pile of furniture on the stairwell. And they can't get this furniture off of her until she starts to calm down some, which kind of relates into the whole idea of poltergeist being associated with people. But we'll get into that later, probably. And we can go on and on. The kid's aunt comes to stay for a time. She's a very devout lady who doesn't believe all this nonsense and figures that they're playing pranks on her. And this poltergeist, turns the lights off in the house and dumps milk over her head, and just generally makes her life miserable for the entire time she's there. And then she's looking for her gloves at the, she's about to leave the house and finds them actually floating above her bed, and they're conducting. This being was making fun of her, basically being or energy or whatever you want to call it, was making fun of her. It was conducting a hymn that she had been singing earlier. And it goes on and on like that. The case got its name of the Black Monk because in the latter stages of the haunting, if you will, whatever you want to call it, I'll call it a haunting because that's the easiest way to refer to it. In the latter stages of this haunting, the people in the house and the neighbors were actually seeing this spectral figure that took the form of like a monk in dark robes. which tied into a local legend about a monk that had been hung for, you know, sexual assault, basically, back in the Middle Ages. So, you know, I mean, this case, you know, Wilson comments after his chapters and chapters about this case that it basically had it all. You know, if you wanted to find out something about the poltergeist phenomena, this case had it all. So the Black Monk is one of the cases I cover. I talk about another one that William Roll covered in Olive Hill, Kentucky. And then, you know, I outline a couple of other cases in the book as well.
So the idea is to give the feel for traditional poltergeist and then compare and contrast that with Bigfoot. Is that right?
Exactly. Well, to compare and contrast that with the Class B phenomena that have been associated with Bigfoot,
gotcha,
which may not necessarily be Bigfoot.
Right.
Let's take an example. So, Woodnox. You know, you watch any of the Bigfoot shows, you watch Bigfoot documentaries, you watch any of that kind of stuff, and you know, one of the ways that people try to track the attention of these creatures is by, you know, knocking on trees. Now, we don't even have to go to the poltergeist lore to discover paranormal phenomena that do wood knocking. If you look at the history of spiritualism, the Fox sisters, back in the 1800s, you know, the very first thing that happened when they started to communicate with the spirits was they were getting raps on the walls and on tables and so forth. And table rapping was a big thing during the Victorian spiritualist seance movement. You know, the spirits all the time, the quote unquote spirits, whatever you want to call it, energies, all the time were knocking on wood. You know, so it doesn't take much to come to the idea that you know, that this idea of wood knocking is not just specific to Sasquatch, but it's also specific to the poltergeist, and it is in fact a classic sign of the poltergeist phenomena. In one of Hans Holzer's cases in his book Ghost, the farm was in Switzerland, and I believe their name was Luthold or something along that line. There's an incident where the farmer and his wife are sitting in the kitchen, basically, and something knocks at the door. They get up, they open the door, there's nobody there. Now, they've been having poltergeist phenomena of varying sorts around the farm, so they were kind of like, okay, whatever. I went back to sit down. Again, there's a knock at the door. They go, there's nothing there. Third time, the wife decides that she's going to sit close to the door. And when the knocking sounds again, she throws the door open in time to see a piece of wood fall to the ground. So this poltergeist had been using a piece of wood to knock on wood to make the door knocking sounds. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
So, you know, so this is, and that's just one example. I mean, you know, I talk about one of the things that Sasquatches are famous for, supposedly. If you watched Monster Quest back in the day, in the episode of Sasquatch Attacks, happens actually in Northern Ontario, not terribly far from where I am, except you have to get there by plane. But you know, the climax to that case, that episode, was they're, you know, they're at the cabin, and something is throwing stones out of the forest onto the roof of the cabin. And, you know, some poor schmuck cameraman had to stand out there with an infrared camera, a night vision camera, trying to find whatever this was while everybody else was huddled in terror inside the cabin, which I thought was kind of amusing. But so Sasquatch is supposedly known for stone throwing. If you go to the poltergeist lore, however, you find out very quickly that stone throwing and throwing of objects is a classic, another classic sign of the poltergeist phenomena. Guy Lyon Playfair, in his book on the Enfield poltergeist, which is another famous poltergeist case. Yes, who
I got to interview him before he passed. Oh, okay. Yeah, it was very
neat. So he talks about in that book, I think it's called Haunted, just Haunted, or This House is Haunted, that's what it was. In that book, he talks about a case in Brazil. Young lady is kind of the focus of a poltergeist case. Her parents have the local priest come and try to exorcise her. That doesn't work out too well. Poltergeists are really, really difficult to get rid of. In the Black Monk case, in fact, the poltergeist there, when they tried to exorcise it, actually took a sort of an anti-Christian bent for a while and did some kind of sacrilegious things in the house. But they tried to exorcise this girl. They had no success. One of their neighbors was a spiritist. It's one of the Afro-Caribbean religions that is kind of based in spiritualism, but is different. It's kind of difficult to explain, but this neighbor was a spiritist, offered to take the girl into his home and see if he and the elders in his group could help her at all. At which point, his house was showered with stones. I don't remember the exact number, but they actually counted up the stones that had materialized and hit this house. And something along the line, there were probably over 300 stones that hit this house. There probably weren't even that many stones in the neighborhood. These stones were appearing from nowhere and hitting his house. Again, the stone throwing thing, poltergeist, Sasquatch, could be either one.
They happen in both.
They happen in both.
We're having a great conversation with W.T. Watson all about the forest poltergeist, and we'll be back right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Parabox, and Parabox is made for people like us who love the paranormal. And once again, we're joined by the mastermind behind Parabox himself, Jim Hamilton. Jim, so glad to have you back on the show again. Could you explain to the folks the concept behind Parabox?
Our designs are as diverse and as intriguing as the supernatural world itself, from mysterious cryptids like Bigfoot and Chupacabra, to chilling ghost stories, haunted locations, and even mind-boggling topics like Area 51 and alien encounters. We've explored a lot over the last 7 years, and guess what? We've only scratched the surface. Imagine wearing a shirt that not only features a cool design, but also kickstarts conversations about these mysterious topics wherever you happen to be. It's like wearing a piece of the unknown that keeps the intrigue alive.
Well, I'm absolutely amazed by how intricate they are.
We love adding those sneaky details that make you do a double, triple, or even a quadruple take. Think hidden symbols and subtle nods that only the sharpest eyes will catch. It's like wearing a piece of art that spins a paranormal tale. Each shirt design contains a password that will unlock our monthly challenge. And hey, not only are our tees a visual adventure, but they're also super soft and comfy. Guaranteed to become your new favorite in no time.
And really, the t-shirts, they're a game too.
Like I mentioned before, every shirt we send is basically a puzzle in disguise. And at Parabox, it's not about wearing a puzzle, it's about diving into the thrill of solving it. We throw in clues, codes, and visuals that will put your mind to the test. Plus, each tee comes with a handy content card explaining the theme and pointing you towards our monthly challenge. And trust me, each month is a new adventure, with some months being trickier than others. If you're clever enough to crack the challenge, you could score yourself some pre-Parabox merch. It's like a monthly brain teaser with a chance to snag some cool gear.
Simply put, Jim, I think people just need to get Parabox. And you've got a special deal for them, right?
Absolutely I do, Jim. For all your paranormal podcast listeners, this one's for you. Use the code JIM20 at checkout and you'll snag a 20% discount on your order. That offer is not only good for our paranormal tees, but for our national park shirts as well. Also, be sure to follow Parabucks Monthly on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok for more paranormal content, as well as contests and giveaways. So head on over to ParabucksMonthly.com and use promo code JIM20 to start your paranormal adventure today.
That's right. Go to ParabucksMonthly.com and take advantage of that great deal. Thanks, Jim, for taking some time out of your very busy schedule. Now I know you're going to get back to designing more great shirts. No purchase necessary to be entered into their monthly drawing. You can find all the details at ParabucksMonthly.com. Thanks, Parabucks.
If you love the Paranormal Podcast, be sure to check out Jim Harold's Campfire, where ordinary people share their extraordinary stories of ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, and terrifying encounters. Find it for free wherever you listen to this podcast. Tune in to Jim Harold's Campfire today. Now we return to the Paranormal Podcast.
So here's a question for you. Sure. And this is something that really interests me. You have a chapter on thought forms. I mean, one of my favorite interviews I've ever done was with David Weatherly about the topic of tulpas. The idea that not only can we experience things, but we can actually create things. And people think when you say that, you mean, oh, you imagined it. No. The idea with a tulpa is that you literally create something. And there have been supposed cases where people have been able to do it. The Philip experiment up north in Canada there is one. So seeing that there are these commonalities, could some of these creatures be thought forms, could be tulpas? And what did you find out about that?
Absolutely. So I use the term thought form. A tulpa is actually a being that is created through a very specific process of Tibetan Buddhist meditation. And so I like to use thought form because it is more
broader.
It's a Western esoteric term that you can use without reference to, you know, the Tibetans. You know, the classic case there was Alexandra David Neal, who wrote a book about her experiences in Tibet, and she did this intense meditative retreat and supposedly created this little monk that followed her around that people could see. But she's not the only person who talks about these things. There's a Western occultist, Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki, who wrote a book along with Herbie Brennan called The Magical Use of Thought Forms. And in this book, she talks about how there's basically a triangle of causation for forming these creatures, these beings, that requires desire, a strong desire to make this thing happen. Visualization, which is the ability to actually form a picture of whatever this is, and imagination, which is the ability to bring it to life in your mind. Okay. So if you think about the Sasquatch phenomena, we have how many people out in the woods every weekend looking for Sasquatch, right? We have people who have a very clear idea in their mind what this creature looks like. And we have things like the Patterson-Gimlin film and so forth that people are patterning their thoughts around. We have also that whole process of imagination of bringing this being to life, because these people are not just looking for a static image, they're looking for a creature, and they have theories about how it behaves. They talk at length about how it behaves, what it does, how it hunts, how it moves along game trail, all these kinds of things. They have developed a whole story around Sasquatch. So yeah, it's entirely possible that some of these things that people are seeing out in the woods are things that have been created by human thought. And in case you think that, that how does that account for physical evidence and so forth? There's there is some evidence that that these beings have at least some limited ability to actually affect their physical environment. So, yeah, you know, it's a really interesting idea. It's a really interesting theory. You know, there are a lot of people in the magical world who swear by it and claim that, you know, I talk about in the book the, let's see, let me think.
There's a lot when you have a book like this. There's a lot of information to process. Sometimes it could be a little difficult to find a particular place in time. Go ahead.
But basically, what it was a group of occultists who were working together to make a thought form that would protect an island where baby seals were being clubbed. They were very environmentally aligned, right? And there were sightings of this being, you know, on the beach, walking amongst the seals after they did this working. Who's to say that at least some of the Sasquatch sightings may actually be thought forms. And some of these disturbances, you know, because we saw in the Philip experiment that, we got the wood knocking and that sort of thing happening there. Some of these disturbances that people are encountering out in the woods may be as a result of thought forms. I mean, particularly when you have a group of researchers who are out there just really putting a lot of energy into it, there's no telling what could happen.
You talk about demons in the book. Is there a thought that Bigfoot could be some kind of demon, some kind of dark energy?
I have actually done a presentation called "It Ain't Demons." I had an occasion to do this for another group. I don't think that demons are super are really good match for the Class B phenomena that we have out there. I don't buy into I'm not aligned to the Judeo-Christian idea about demons. There are spirits that, you know, were recognized all the way back to Mesopotamia that do not have the best interests of human beings in mind.
Well, the jinn.
And you can add in the jinn as well. Although I see the jinn as being a Middle Eastern version of the fair folk. They can be both positive and negative depending on how they're treated and how you treat with them. The demonic, those beings that we might think of as demonic are entirely negative. They do not have the best interests of human beings in mind at all. They are characterized by a number of different things that I outline in the book, but I don't think that Sasquatch is a demon, one of the Nephilim, which is another theory that pops up every now and again, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me from the standpoint of the research that I've done. You know, the demonic entities seem to be really interested in possessing people and oppressing people, and they seem to be very predatory in nature. Whereas what we see in a lot of these Class B phenomena, with the wood knocking and so forth, what we see is not really negative. You know, it's okay. Well, there's something out here. And sometimes it seems that it can be a little aggressive, starts throwing stones and driving people out of campsites and stuff like that. Or, you know, the vocalizations scare people out of areas or that sort of thing. But it doesn't seem to be as deliberately malicious as a demonic entity. A demonic entity also seems to have a focus on a particular person. And, so again, these Class B phenomena often happen to groups of people. And why would a being that's interested in trying to take over a body be doing things like knocking in the woods?
Right.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, go finish your thought.
Yeah. So, my idea about that is that, demons, which is a very rare type of spirit. It's not nearly as common as some of the ghost hunting shows would have you believe. demons would tend to, I think, inhabit more populated areas because there is, frankly, more prey there. So the idea of some demon haunting the woods just doesn't seem to gel for me.
Now you were talking a little bit about we touched on the djinn, we touched on the fair folk. So what about the trickster side of it? How do you feel about that? Could Sasquatch be a little bit of a trickster? Maybe not sinister, but poking a little bit of fun with us.
Well, almost every indigenous culture has some version of the trickster, right? And if you stop and think about it, trickster type entities are probably not a bad match for some of the stuff that goes on out in the woods. If you were talking about an entity that's basically mischievous. That maybe doesn't care, is kind of morally amoral, likes getting a rise out of people. I mean, think about how much fun a trickster would have, in a situation where you've got a bunch of people out and they're doing serious Sasquatch research and they're looking for giant bipedal primates, and you have some trickster spirit that comes along and is doing the wood knocks and doing the stone throwing and maybe leaving tracks behind and doing all kinds of crazy stuff to get these folks' attention. It gets they get excited about this. They go running around. Everything requires, some kind of energy to live, right? I mean, these trickster type spirits may actually be feeding off this kind of energy. It's a theory. It's definitely a theory. There's no way to, the problem is everybody looks at these things and they go, well, you can't prove that. It's like, well, no, you can't prove that there's a giant bipedal primate in the woods either.
Right. Right. So, that's a great point.
I mean, and even if somebody does someday bring in the carcass of a Sasquatch and prove to science once and for all that there is a giant bipedal primate living in the woods, it still doesn't account for stories like that Stan Gordon one that I was telling earlier. It only solves part of the mystery. And we have so many, I think my plea in this book is that rather than getting locked into a silo, what I really would like to see happen is I'd like to see people looking at these mysteries from a more Freudian perspective, from a 10,000 foot perspective, where they're looking at, look, there's this poltergeist stuff that goes along with our Class B stuff. And, we have apparitions that, are so solid appearing that people actually mistake them for people. We have the thought form thing that I was talking about. Some of these disturbances in the wood could definitely be the result of, people encroaching on territory that's, claimed by the fair folk. There's all of these different, it doesn't have to be just one thing. And, and this is my plea probably throughout all of my books, is it doesn't have to be just one thing. We don't have to have the universal field theory of the paranormal. We can look and say, hey, there's lots of different theories out there and there's mystery. And that's 99% of the fun of it.
I would agree. I would agree. And it's always a lot of fun talking to W.T. Watson. W.T., tell us where we can find the Forest Poltergeist Class B Encounters in the Paranormal. Where can we find it? And all your books.
So all of my books are available via Amazon. For those of you who are, paperback readers, they're available by paperback as paperbacks. If you are an ebook reader, they're available on Kindle. If you happen to be one of those folks that subscribes to Kindle Unlimited, they're available through KU. So they're very much available by Amazon.
Absolutely. Very easy to get all the content. W.T. Watson, it's always a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us tonight and being our guest on the Paranormal Podcast. Continued success with this book and everything you do.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast. I certainly appreciate it, and we thank W.T., always a fascinating guest. And if you enjoy this show, please tell a friend. You know, sometimes I worry, is the word getting out there about our shows? You know, there's so many shows out there. We know that. And sometimes I think one of the longest running or the longest running paranormal podcast that I know of, this very show, sometimes gets lost in the mix with the newness that is out there. But sometimes they're classics that deserve to be elevated. And I think this is just such a show. So please share this show and the campfire, of course, with your friends. We would appreciate it very much. And we will talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe. And stay spooky. Bye-bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.